My name is Charles Goodhart, and I'm here because I'm one of the organizing team of the London Financial Regulation Seminar. And tonight's lecture is being held under the auspices of the London Financial Regulation Seminar. And we're pleased and proud to introduce Sir Andrew Large, who is Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, with special responsibility for financial stability. Andrew has had an extraordinarily successful and wide-ranging career, which has encompassed a variety of private sector roles, including non-financial firms. He began with BP, and also in the financial sector. He's worked in the financial sector with Orion and Swiss Bank Corporation, and most recently as Deputy Chairman of Barclays and Chairman of Euroclear. Now, in addition to his wide private sector experience, he has had long experience of public service, having been chairman of SIB. For the younger ones of you, I should add that that is the Securities and Investment Board, and was chairman of that for 5 years. And he has served on innumerable other panels, councils, associations, and so on. Sir Andrew is enormously knowledgeable about financial bodies, their problems, and therefore about financial stability. The bank is very lucky to have got him, and so, of course, are we, if only for a very brief and short time tonight, and so as not to use up any more of that precious time. Andrew, I pass over to you.
Well, is the acoustics all right? Charles, thank you very much for that introduction, and also for the opportunity to speak here this evening and on a favourite subject of mine. The financial system has been in the vanguard of globalisation of economic activities. And in the past 30 years, we've seen a transformation of the financial scene. And I would argue that just as the financial world has become significantly more complex, with an ever more interconnected global network across firms and countries, so too has the challenge been transformed for those involved in financial stability oversight. And that is my theme tonight. Much of what I'm about to say may be familiar, but what I've tried to do is to tie these subjects together to provide a picture of the whole area that we grapple with. So I hope you'll permit me to sacrifice some depth to accommodate some breadth. It's a wide terrain. I'd like first to consider what financial stability oversight is and why it's important. Then, what has changed in the financial marketplace and the challenges that this has brought. And finally, the response of the public authorities to these challenges. Unquestionably, financial stability is a critical ingredient in a high-performing market economy. Although its definition has been an elusive subject of endless fascination to generations of commentators, I agree with Raymond Goldschmidt, who said, "It's hard to define, but recognizable when encountered." But any definition would surely refer to the crucial roles of confidence, resilience, and reliable liquidity. These seem to me to be the indicators of what is a state of financial stability. In times of instability or crisis, that confidence, and with it liquidity, can evaporate. Bank runs are phenomena that result from loss of confidence, resulting from or causing withdrawal of liquidity. The fear of collapse of other non-bank types of financial institution could also give rise to a drain on liquidity. The huge cost of preparing for Y2K was to a large extent about preventing the dangers of loss of liquidity. And the horrific events of 9/11 required a temporary massive injection of liquidity to maintain the functioning of the system. The starting point for this confidence is the players in the marketplace. It relies on integrity within individual firms and markets, effective standards and high-quality prudential controls and risk management practices. But to underpin integrity and confidence in the financial system as a whole also requires financial stability oversight. In the first instance, this relies on effective supervision. This is a key aspect of the prevention of financial instability. Such financial stability oversight must also look at the system as a whole. So it's involved with the oversight of concentrations and of risk correlations, interrelationships and interdependencies. There's a premium on understanding channels of risk transfer and likely behaviour in response to shocks. This is what enables an appropriate policy response. Real effort is needed to try to understand the dynamics of collective and sometimes irrational behaviour of firms, their clients and counterparties, particularly behaviour that could lead to one-way markets. In a downward market, these can be the scourge of stability and the destroyer of liquidity. The business of oversight of and possible intervention in the financial system falls to public authorities. The justification for this involvement is accepted by all but the freest of free marketeers. Financial stability can be looked on as a public good, and the costs to society of crises and instability can go well beyond the cost borne by players within the financial services arena itself. Not only is it important in providing an effective monetary transmission mechanism, but collapse and instability can lead to decline in aggregate demand and rise in unemployment. Research suggests that the average cumulative output loss of a banking crisis in an emerging market economy can be around 15% of GDP and up to 25% in developed economies. The roles and aims of the public authorities, a combination of supervisors, central banks, and government, embrace two interdependent fields. First, there's the process of oversight itself, spotting risk concentrations and threats that could cause instability, and taking actions to mitigate those threats in a variety of ways. Second, however, there is, as a last resort, the mechanism for intervention, if things go wrong and crisis is threatened or actually occurs. And things will go wrong. A zero-risk environment would surely not only be impossible, but it would also be undesirable. The moral hazard which would ensue, together with unwelcome restriction of market processes, could ultimately add to, rather than detract from, social cost. We need to be in a position to decide about, and where necessary, to act in occasionally injecting liquidity and support for particular firms and markets. Breaking the chain of adverse behaviour may sometimes be necessary to restore confidence in the integrity of the system as a whole. Using financial stability oversight to reduce the costs to society requires sophisticated, up-to-date techniques. Despite today's complexity, the basic concepts in relation to oversight have not changed. Concentrations of risk have been with us since financial markets began, and so have the mechanisms for the transfer of risks. The concepts of guarantees, options, and of securities transfer date back into history, and so too does the concept of speculative or misconceived excess being deflated by a variety of possible macro or micro shocks. References to the use of derivatives can be traced right back to the Sumerians in Mesopotamia in 4,000 years ago. But the financial world today has globalized both across the borders and different kinds of firms. Risk transfer processes have mushroomed, and there has developed a corresponding will and ability to exploit them. The new world is characterized by new concentrations of risk. They can be built and dissipated with bewildering speed. Before looking at the consequences of the changes for financial stability oversight, it's worth reflecting on the main causes of this new world. There are, of course, many drivers, but to my mind, the development of the new products and risk transfer techniques is based on the preconditions of liberalization and technological advance. As to liberalization, it was little wonder that the rise in popularity of derivatives in the global economy was stimulated by the emergence in the 1960s of that most liberal of markets, the international capital market. This burgeoning and open marketplace provided the preconditions to develop the new techniques. Regulation was minimal and market imposed. Disintermediation and securitization gathered pace from the early 1980s. And as derivative instruments were developed, new players, including hedge funds and others, entered the scene. So today we see a global marketplace of truly astonishing size and breadth, whose contracts straddle both national boundaries and the old functional areas of banking, insurance, and securities. The old silos are no more. The international capital market was, in my view, itself a major stimulus in encouraging individual governments to liberalize their markets. The new techniques employed could lead to a lower cost of capital. In addition, the market and its capabilities began to highlight the ineffectiveness of national barriers and restrictive practices. It gave governments the courage to dismantle restrictions and barriers despite protest from those who, in a series of big bangs, lost their franchises. The examples of the international Swiss franc and sterling, for that matter, debt markets highlight this. In each case, the authorities in the 1970s used to impose flow controls on new bond issues through queues. But this could be bypassed as derivatives and swaps developed. So Swiss franc liabilities, for example, could be created by borrowing US dollars on an unrestricted basis and swapping them outside the jurisdiction of the Swiss authorities into Swiss francs. So this caused a global rethink as the national grip of the authorities had ceased to be effective. While liberalization was an important trigger, technological advance also played a vital role. We may not understand its full impact yet, just as it took us time to exploit fully the benefits of the printing press or electricity and the motor car. But the advance and speed of communications, with its erosion of geographical and national barriers, spawned the development of often derivatized financial instruments and risk transfer techniques. The concepts involved in this risk transfer may not be new, but the instruments to handle them, to quantify their value, to measure them, and to judge the risks inherent in them are. The consequences of these developments, whose impact took off in the 1980s, have been quite dramatic. Firstly, they've enabled greater dispersion of risks. Banks, at the heart of the financial system, used to act as warehouses, with loan assets they generated staying on the books until maturity and normally repayment. The balance sheet was the net result of these events. But today, banks approach matters in a fundamentally different way. They review their balance sheets intraday. They ask themselves, what is the opportunity cost of not altering the balance sheet? And they're then in a position to act. Assets can be disposed of, packaged, securitized and sold, in size and fast. That's what's so new. So risk can be and is dispersed across the system globally, not only from bank to bank, but also between different types of financial institutions, as well, of course, as to private individuals and to corporate entities. This can create concentrations of risk in new areas, and often with new players, who may or may not be well informed about what they're doing. But this set of processes adds to the opacity of the financial system. It's difficult to see where risks reside. So despite steps forward through enhanced disclosure and improved accounting standards, there have been other steps back towards opacity. The result of the sheer complexity, speed of movement of risks, and in some cases, obfuscation through special purpose vehicles or other off-balance sheet devices. Another implication of the derivatized world is the premium it places on risk management. The deployment of intellectual capital in finding new opportunities to create and disperse risk has been prodigious. This, in turn, places a real burden on the managers of the great array of risks and interdependencies, and on those supervising the entities that take them. A particular feature of these risk management processes is the reliance on modelling techniques. Although when used judiciously, models are a valuable tool, they also have limitations and hazards in the wrong hands. First, they're only as good as the assumptions on which they're based. And second, they can provide a false reassurance that liquidity to deliver assumed value will be available. This leads to the question of measurement and accounting for values and risks. Inherited systems of accounting with historic cost conventions for banking and insurance bring real tensions in today's world. There's understandable concern regarding the added volatility which the developing fair value techniques can give rise to in relation to reported earnings and disclosed values. But equally, the need for management of risks and for comparison of values across all sectors with a mark-to-market capability is how business is actually managed and conducted. That's why I've for some time argued that a resolution of the conflict is so important. The lack of consensus makes this a difficult process, needing consideration of the governance and control process of accounting quite apart from the standards themselves. And in this respect, I recommend a recent report by the Group of 30 as outlining a possible way forward. Paradoxically, the existence of standards of risk management or prudential control themselves can lead to unintended consequences. For example, if banks all have similar approaches to risk management or all use similar models, or if rules require them all to provide more capital at times of economic downturn, then they may all react similarly to any given shock. This could itself amplify market movements and trigger liquidity difficulties, despite the best intentions. There's also the question of legal certainty. If counterparties doubt an institution's strength or solvency, their behavior may be influenced if they feel that complex and untested types of contract may not close out, particularly in adversity. Such concerns lay behind the LTCM crisis in 1998. Counterparties feared LTCM might be insolvent. They could sense a drain of liquidity from LTCM which might precipitate collapse. And if collapse occurred, the vast array of complex contracts within LTCM might not close out. The dimensions of the exposures were considerable, and a disorderly run on LTCM, triggered in part by a lack of legal certainty, could well have provoked a serious liquidity situation. No surprise that there was a coordinated purchase by the main creditors to enforce an orderly wind down. So a key lesson for financial stability oversight is the need to encourage ways of improving legal certainty. So much for the drivers of change: liberalization, technological advance, and new products. But what about the consequences for the financial markets and their oversight? The first consequence is to highlight the need for examination and possible change in supervisory and regulatory frameworks. What made sense before in terms of separate regulation for each silo of banking, insurance, and securities might look different today. We have also certainly seen a move towards consolidated supervision. I'll return to this general area later. But second, oversight needs an understanding of a number of different soft issues of culture and attitudes to risk which can affect behavior. These can and do vary across different areas of activity. The existence of new concentrations of risk might not matter if their holders are fully aware of the risk implications, or if their likely behavior could be anticipated by other financial participants or the public authorities. But new holders of such risk may not have the same understandings of what the risks consist of as those who generate them. And accordingly, they may behave in unexpected ways when shocks occur. For example, in banking, confidence in the liquidity of the system and expected behavior is underpinned by the presumption that in the absence of a credit event, obligations will be honored at a known time and date. This would typically be on the expiry of a loan contract, the crystallizing event, if you like. In general insurance, on the other hand, the industry is used to handling crystallizing events quite differently. Rather than acting as the trigger for immediate payment of due amounts, it may instead lead to discussion or even dispute, the results of which will determine how much is eventually paid and when. So risk transfer contracts straddling the two areas may engender expectations that in practice may harbor surprises with unexpected outcomes and adverse behavior. A key ingredient of life in today's financial world, of course, is the new players or the increased significance of previously smaller players, encouraged as they have been by liberalization and new risk transfer techniques. Firstly, there is the advent of globally active, large complex financial institutions, or LCFIs. These create a particular challenge for public policy. They are built on highly sophisticated understandings of the global marketplace. Their deployment of intellectual capital has been dramatic, and they've overcome both technical and juridical barriers so as to operate on a global basis. You cannot badge them into the historical categories. Are they banks? Are they securities firms? Or are they insurers? Of course, you can categorize them by their historical roots. The large so-called broker-dealers, such as Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, come from the securities side. The big banks, Citigroup and HSBC, come from the banking side. But today, they're all involved in convergent thought processes and operations, even if their precise legal structures, and in many cases regulatory arrangements, may differ. They're all involved in considering in real time whether they are comfortable with the balance sheet of assets and liabilities that they have. And they're all involved in risk transfer techniques to adjust to a desired proprietary outcome. Their scope is multifunctional and multinational, and this enables them to maximize opportunities for return. But it also creates challenges both for the markets and for the authorities. With global firms, if there should be a failure, then who will oversee its resolution? And will there be any safety net to counter what could be significant economic and social costs globally? Which set of taxpayers in which countries will be prepared to share the burden to support such LCFIs? This highlights a real tension in the globalized world. The markets have globalized, and so have the firms. But to a large measure, the oversight apparatus remains nationally based. This is an important area which will provide all those of us involved in financial sector oversight with major challenges for years to come. The hedge funds are increasingly active players, employing alternative investment techniques and attracting a multitude of investors searching for higher yields. They often operate globally on the strength of the derivatized world. There's been a dramatic growth in hedge funds. Data suggests that the past 8 years alone have seen the value of assets rise by nearly 450%. Many of them are unregulated in a prudential sense and are typically characterized by large proprietary positions, sometimes with an emphasis on unconventional assets and arbitrage positions. The complex and diverse operations of hedge funds can, of course, help to arbitrage away pricing mistakes and to integrate financial markets. But they also raise new questions for financial stability oversight. The areas we need to look at are quite wide. There is, of course, the opacity aspect. What are the underlying concentrations hedge funds hold? But there are also other questions. How leveraged are they? Do lenders to them understand the risks they're taking? And what is the potential impact of confidence and liquidity if they don't? And what would happen if the new investors in hedge funds became disillusioned by their performance? Would it trigger an exodus and cause markets to go one way? And I would stress that many of the issues raised by the attributes of and thought processes within hedge funds themselves are shared increasingly by securities companies and other types of financial institution, including banks. Overseers of financial stability take note. A third group of new players is the non-financial groups who straddle finance and the real economy. I could mention industrial giants like GE. We need to understand their implications and any vulnerabilities they may cause. Next, I want to highlight the rating agencies. The new holders of financial assets find that understanding the credit risks inherent in the assets they hold has become more difficult. So they outsource credit evaluations to the rating agencies as third-party specialists who benefit from economies of scale. Indeed, in the case of collateralized debt obligations, whole categories of assets are dependent on their ratings. But this can give rise to particular vulnerabilities. What happens if there's a rating downgrade? Did the investors in Parmalat bonds rely on the fact that they were rated investment grade? Changes to ratings will be known to all at the same time, and this could trigger mass exodus either by holders of rated assets or, in cases where banks themselves are rated, by depositors or other counterparties. Of course, the rating agencies provide valuable services and information, and their increasingly public significance causes calls for them to be regulated. Now, this is a tricky issue, since in my view, attempts to do so could actually create additional moral hazard, particularly in today's compensation-orientated society. If rating agencies were regulated, who would you blame if mistakes are made? The rating agency, the regulator, or both? Finally, we need to consider the financial stability oversight implications of the networks which increasingly hold the financial system together. These are the plumbing or the nervous system of the financial world. This is the world of payments, clearing, and settlement systems. Such networks can, and do, both generate significant economic benefits, but they also create vulnerabilities. The economic benefits of scale and scope from such networks come as a result of the development of standardized messaging, IT protocols, and other areas of interoperability. However, the universal reliance on these networks makes the financial system increasingly vulnerable to any failure, whether financial or physical. So if the market all settles in one system and is faced by single points of failure, how could we work around these? Secondly, if there is a failure, what about data retrieval? If an entity containing a series of uncompleted transactions fails, how can that data be retrieved or recreated so that you can get markets up and running again? Fortunately, significant effort is being put into developing innovative solutions in this area, which is something which may give confidence to the many who are unfamiliar with this rather complicated area. Now, it'll be clear from the litany of issues I've just mentioned, new players, new products, new risk transfer techniques and interconnections, that the changes in today's world are indeed quite profound in relation to financial stability oversight. But are they net benign or net negative? The world here is sometimes portrayed as being in two designated camps. This may be a bit of a parody, but I'm sure the two protagonists would forgive my little sketch. The bullish view is led by Governor Greenspan. This holds that in the new financial world, banks now possess the enhanced ability to disperse risk, to offload risk to others, be they investors, insurance companies, or whatever. The banks have thereby been able to weather a variety of shocks, which in an earlier age might well have engendered financial instability. The Asian crisis, Russia, 9/11, Enron, I could go on. In each case, the banks came through, and the financial system has demonstrated greater resilience as derivatives and sophisticated risk transfer processes have dispersed risk to a wider audience. The bearish camp is led by Warren Buffett. This points out the opacity of today's world, the difficulty of spotting risk concentrations or judging the behavioural expectations in the face of given types of shock. I think that my view would be that both schools of thought are right. I think in reality it depends on your vantage point. There's surely been improved capital formation, and well-managed banks have indeed been able to weather the shocks, a real positive from the point of view of financial stability oversight. But on the other hand, the added vulnerabilities too are real. So I don't find it surprising that there are calls for a public policy response. So the consequences of liberalisation and the derivatised world of enhanced risk transfer are indeed formidable. There is the breakdown of old barriers, with unfamiliar and new players operating in often unfamiliar territory, uncertainty over concentrations of risk, and with a more difficult or unpredictable set of behaviours and newly created networks whose failure can be catastrophic. Spotting threats is tougher, and there's a premium on intelligence from a broader network to cover a multiple of new transmission channels. The tension between globalised players in a world of national supervisors needs to be managed. But let me not leave you with the impression that we are deterred by the task. On the contrary, challenging certainly, but hopeless certainly not. After all, the marketplace itself has to act prudently, to judge potential behaviour of counterparties, to improve risk management techniques, to understand where concentrations of risk reside and what their dangers are. If firms fail to do so, they go out of business. And as for the public authorities, we all know the maxim or guiding prayer: Lord, let there be failures, but let them be small ones. No better way of encouraging market discipline. We cannot and should not aspire to a zero-risk solution, but we do need to be prepared to take measures to restore confidence if things do go wrong. So as to the public policy response, the first area concerns how we handle our day-to-day activities. These have to be sharpened and broadened to oversee this more complex environment. A real challenge for all of us here in London, given its position as a major international financial centre, where the stability of the system could be impacted by any significant storms from elsewhere. Perhaps I can say a few words about what this means to us at the Bank of England. Responsibility for the overall stability of the financial system as a whole means we undertake activities ranging from behavioural research to oversight of payment and settlement systems, from involvement in standard setting to implementing infrastructural change. To do this efficiently means, as our Governor Mervyn King recently reminded us, that we have to see the wood for the trees. The challenge is, where do you draw the line as to what is important and what less so? This entails a prioritisation process to decide on the extent and degree of potential threats, and also a sunset approach where we subject each area of work to regular review to assess progress and continued relevance. There are a number of interconnected areas of work. These focus both on hard infrastructure, including payment and settlement systems, and on the soft infrastructure, standard setting in areas like accounting, audit, prudential and legal standards. We also analyse key developments in the international arena, for example, in relation to threats of failure of emerging market economies and response to this. As to the second area, the institutional response, there are both national as well as international dimensions. On a national basis, countries increasingly recognise the distinction between supervision, looking at the individual institutions and markets, and the systemic factors involving concentrations, interrelationships, and behaviour in relation to the system as a whole. Each is an essential element in the provision of financial stability oversight. In relation to supervision, some jurisdictions, including the UK, Japan, and Germany, all supervisory functions are carried out within one institution, whereas in others, they're handled by different agencies. Certain countries have combined questions of the systemic issues with those of prudential oversight, and then put investor and consumer protection aspects into separate agencies, the Twin Peaks approach adopted in Australia and France. Yet others still survive with a multiplicity of agencies. The US is a case in point. And it's worth noting that despite all its complexities and conflicts, the health of the US financial sector, as well as its economy, do not appear to have suffered unduly, despite episodes like the S&L crisis. However, the broad trend is to combine investor protection and consumer protection for banking, securities, and insurance, and to split these away from the systemic aspect. The precise architecture in different countries depends on historical, political, and institutional factors. Personally, I feel we've been quite enlightened in the UK. As Charles mentioned, I was the former chairman of the old Securities and Investment Board, a forerunner of today's FSA, and I could certainly see the limitations of the earlier situation. And despite the inevitable challenge, being well addressed in my view, of managing a supervisory authority with the size, scope, and powers of FSA, it reflects the realities of today's environment. And as for financial stability oversight in the UK, this is carried on under the auspices of a standing committee of the three authorities involved, the Treasury, FSA, and the Bank of England. The roles of each party have been carefully thought out in relation to which party is best placed to do what, and laid out in a published memorandum of understanding. The FSA is responsible for the supervision of firms, markets, and clearing systems, and for the conduct of regulatory operations in response to problem cases affecting these players. The valuable intelligence it gains can help in understanding concentrations and threats. The bank has responsibility for the overall stability of the financial system as a whole. Without the need to focus on regulatory responsibilities for the individual firms, we focus on what might disrupt the functioning of the financial system, and especially what might pose a threat to liquidity and what can be done to mitigate it. We also need to be in a position to advise on the extent of possible financial support if major problems do arise, and to provide that support if and as agreed. And the Treasury, of course, has to play a vital role in reflecting government policy as a whole, with a particular scrutiny of developments which ultimately could bring into consideration the need for taxpayers' money. On the global level, things are very different. You could argue intellectually that since national boundaries mean so little in relation to financial stability oversight, there is a case for creating a single global body. In reality, of course, we're nowhere near that, any more than we are to creating global government itself. The difference in political and legal systems and culture clearly make it impracticable. So for the time being, whether at a global or even an EU level, we have to rely on proxies and coordination. The proxy must obviously be as effective as possible, and this explains the activity to create and maintain robust international standards and practice in the institutions and infrastructure of the global market. It explains endeavours to encourage or enforce compliance with them through a variety of measures, including international bodies such as the Basel Committee, IOSCO, Committee on Payment and Settlement Systems, the IMF, and the World Bank, and others too numerous to mention. The Financial Stability Forum is noteworthy too, as it brings together the three key sets of bodies involved in financial stability oversight: central banks, regulators, and finance ministries, to supplement the actions of other international bodies in promoting standards generally. Now, I spoke about identifying threats and the steps to mitigate them, but we also need to be able to intervene if things do go wrong. In a non-zero risk environment, failure is a possibility. So we need to look at both mitigants in relation to the impacts of financial crisis and how to restore confidence. This is true both for financial crises, which could occur as a result of business failure, as well as possible major operational disruption, whether from terrorism, cyber failure, or natural calamity. These are situations where predictability is so vital, when normal mechanisms for decision-making may be in abeyance. I've left until last the tricky question of emergency liquidity injection and lender of last resort. This is an area full of mystique and ambiguity. Intervention, as the late Charles Kindleberger said, is an art form and not a science. My contention is that whilst an aspect of such ambiguity may be inevitable or even necessary, the demands of today's complex world for enhanced predictability of behaviour and transparency should also not be ignored. Ultimately, public policy may require emergency liquidity injection through lender of last resort facilities. This may be justified to defend the public good of financial stability, which the market itself cannot provide. I stress the word ultimately, for this is a genuine last resort after all other efforts have failed. The granting of any such support does, however, contain a basic dilemma. On the one hand, there's a strong case for market discipline to avoid the dangers of moral hazard. This is the case for ambiguity as to whether and when the lender of last resort facility would be deployed. On the other hand, people want predictability of process. Who can be expected to do what if problems do arise? In the UK, we're quite advanced in addressing these dilemmas. Our former governor, Sir Edward George, in a speech here at the London School of Economics in 1993, outlined the five key principles of lender of last resort assistance. They're equally valid today. To Precy, firstly, explore every commercial option. Ensure the key benefits come to the financial system, not the shareholders. Aim towards a clear exit. Treat with care any details of the support given. And distinguish between problems of liquidity and those of solvency. A difficult but crucial ex ante question. We don't have a formal agreement as to how these principles are to be handled case by case, nor, of course, the circumstances under which emergency liquidity might be made available. Therein lies ambiguity. But equally, there is an acknowledgement that the issues might arise, and the Standing Committee's remit includes decision-making and implementation in relation to any emergency liquidity, as well as a clear statement of the roles of the three parties. Internationally and globally, the situation is more complex and diverse. In some countries, the subject is still taboo, both process and policy decision. This might be due to a lack of clarity of roles and powers. But to my mind, this transparency deficit is not conducive to systemic confidence, either within given jurisdictions or on a global basis. But whilst there may be validity in a lack of transparency in relation to the actual policy decision, certainly ex ante, there need, in my view, be less fear in relation to having more transparency of the processes that surround it. There will, of course, always be varying views of when market or institutional failure should be allowed to play themselves out, and when all else has failed, intervention is justified. Prior clarity here might provoke market gaming to the detriment, ultimately, of the taxpayer. But in general, transparency of process can contribute to confidence. Some indeed argue that you should improve transparency generally to a point where lender of last resort support could be withdrawn altogether and let the market take the fallout from and absorb the shocks as they arise. This, I fear, gets into the realms of philosophy and political thought, and as a mere central banker, I'll leave that to others. Some countries are less inclined to such opacity. To quote Governor Heikensten of the Riksbank in Sweden, those who have lived through a crisis are generally in favour of a transparent process. Now, I've ranged widely on many factors which, at least in my view, are relevant to financial stability oversight. So So in concluding, let me try to draw together some of the principal themes in what I've been saying. I'm naturally well aware that there are many positive features of today's environment. But central bankers are sometimes accused of being pessimists and seeing the glass half empty. In our defense, I suppose it's our job to think out what could go wrong and be ready accordingly. The first message I want to leave you with is that we're concerned about financial stability because of the potential economic and social costs arising from financial instability. Private markets will not always reflect these costs fully, and prima facie, there's a need for public policy oversight. Second, the degree of complexity and interconnectedness has increased dramatically in recent years. Here I would point to market liberalization, technological advance, and the development of a range of new instruments for transferring risk. Third, market participants need to be aware that financial stability starts with them. Integrity and sensible restraint are the bedrocks of stability. This requires heightened awareness that the leverage in the system as a whole, encouraged by the new risk transfer techniques, contains its own vulnerabilities. Fourth, in responding to the changing environment, the financial authorities have had to adapt their models and procedures for regulation and oversight. Greater disclosure and transparency are antidotes to the information deficits in an increasingly complex and sometimes opaque financial system. International cooperation is at a premium, both in delivering a consolidated view of globally active firms and in seeking to clarify who is expected to do what when difficulties arise. They need to match the level of technical expertise in the private sector and to contend with new and heightened risks, such as in the area of business continuity. Fifth, as a central bank, we need to be as clear as we can about the nature of our contribution to the oversight process. At the core is our concern with the maintenance of liquidity and our capacity to inject it when necessary. Much of our financial stability work is aimed at identifying potential liquidity strains and what responses are likely to be most effective. And lastly, whilst the challenges for oversight may be daunting, progress in addressing these challenges is significant. But do not expect a zero-risk environment, and do not demand it. Fear you might fail, is the antidote for instability. It'll go a long way to underpin the long-term health of the financial system. Thank you very much.
Sir Andrew has said that he would be happy to take some questions. Having read my papers today, I might just emphasize that this has been a financial regulation lecture, and there's been plenty to, it's a wide area, and I hope that you will focus your questions on financial regulation issues tonight. Yes?
Well, a couple of points. My experience is that although there are obviously sort of there's a historical background whereby a number of regulators still do operate business by business, I think this is changing and changing quite fast. Now, of course, the question of what are the proper prudential standards arises, and amongst prudential standards, capital is one measure that can be used and is helpful both to firms themselves in assessing their own prudential situation and for the regulator. And so there will be, I'm sure, a continued emphasis on capital adequacy, be it for banks or insurance companies or securities companies. Of course, there are other aspects of prudential work. The whole question of fitness and properness, for example, starts with the people, and that's an area of importance. And there are other fields as well, which I think will merit attention over time, including the way in which organizations maintain liquidity positions. I talked about concentrations of risk and people therefore having to have a heightened awareness of how and where they can get hold of liquidity when they need it. So I think that the premise behind your question is fair historically, but I think this is a period of quite intense change. I'd prefer not to sort of, you know, put it in an absolute way. Capital is important, but I would certainly agree with you that it is not the only factor that people should be looking at. I have to say, I don't think it is the only factor they look at.
Peter?
In terms of sufficient overview, I mean, I think it would be wise for any overseer of financial stability to say that there's always more one would like to be able to see. I tried to outline pretty openly what seemed to us to be a number of the challenges, and therefore the areas where we try to enhance our understanding and the knowledge that we have. Of course, we could always have more information and better understandings, and it's something that we're working on continually. As to the balance of fear and greed, I think I'd put it a little bit differently. I certainly think that fear of failure is a factor that can be significant in encouraging participants in markets to take care and to think through the consequences of their own actions. I think the other side of it, however, isn't so much greed. I think it's that you do need a process of financial stability oversight to assist, as and where it can, in helping to maintain the stability. Of course, greed, I suppose you use the term because it is that which could lead to concentrations that may, in retrospect, appear to have been unwise. I would accept that, that there are areas, and we've seen some, where such concentrations have been unwisely built up. If you care to define those as greed, well, that's a way you can put it.
You
were asking me about Alan Greenspan's approach, and you were asking me, you made some comment which you might like to repeat, because I wasn't absolutely certain what you were asking about liquidity being underwritten. I wasn't quite sure what that was about.
Could you speak up? Greenspan put.
You mean you mean the extent to which there's a belief that liquidity will always be available? Can you just
how it affects financial institutions' ability, the willingness
I think there you'll have to ask the Fed. I mean, I gave the analogy because it's one that's been widely commented on, and I do think that there is a very fair point that a dispersion of risk from banks has itself been a very positive factor. As to how that interfaces with the Fed's monetary policy activities is really something that I think you have to ask them. I really don't have any great feelings about it.
Phil.
Well, I hope we do a little bit more than making speeches, but I think I deliberately tonight emphasized more the micro than the macro dimension, because I think it's in the micro arena that there's been, in many respects, more rapid change than there has in the macro economy. I'm not sure I'd necessarily make a distinction. I mean, if we detected vulnerabilities arising in the macro area, we'd pay just as much attention to them as we would in the micro. And in a way, when one's talking about concentrations due to a number of parties all being taking a given positions, you're getting very close to macro territory. So I think all the comments I made about the way that we try and understand what they are and the machinery that and the response that there's been, not just by us, of course, but by supervisory authorities and governments as well, stands just as much in that area as it does in the micro.
Adam Garrett.
Andrew, John
Davis.
Can I just
ask
the bringing back to the point you made in commenting on Alan Greenspan, namely that the ability to transfer risk to the insurance was valuable. I'm very conscious that insurance companies are only beginning now to address how to work out realistic liabilities. We're seeing some of the consequences of that in the UK. Globally, we're seeing pretty slow action from the IAIS. And in Europe, we're potentially going to have to wait till 2010 to see Solvency II brought in, and probably at the same time before international accounting standards manage to get an agreement on the same issue of realistic liabilities. Can I ask your comments on the bank's views on whether we can speed up this process of getting a better measure of risk in the insurance as we have in banking?
I think this is actually work which is to a very large extent being done in FSA and very valuable, and I think groundbreaking work is actually being done to try and speed it up. It's not easy because it requires differences of approach, differences of ways of thought, and I think we've already seen the beginnings of this process, and I think myself that it'll evolve more rapidly than you might feel. At IAS, the international dimension is very difficult because insurance is regulated in such different ways in different places, so getting an international consensus is by no means easy. I mean, for example, in the United States, insurance regulation is to a very significant extent handled on a state level and often differently in the different areas. So even getting a sort of federal view or a transnational view is not so easy. I think it's fair to say that supervisors and those involved in financial stability oversight have become increasingly aware, of course, of the insurance dimension, as it's become clear that, as you said, risk can be transferred to that area and from it in ways that it wasn't earlier. So a lot of emphasis and thoughts being given to it, and not a little intellectual capital. So I would be, I mean, I don't underestimate the difficulties, but I think that real progress will be made. Well, if you ask what powers, the answer is, in a formal sense, very few, if any. But the subtle thing and the interesting thing about financial stability oversight is that it isn't all about power, or not all about formal power. If you are looking at setting standards, for example, this doesn't happen through somebody saying, look, I've got a power to enforce this because and to make it happen, because, sure, but the power that the standard that you're looking to create will inevitably require the input of the best practice from the marketplace, just as much as it may the feelings of what's important from a public policy sense. So you have a fusion of the two. So the fact that that formal powers may not be there doesn't, I think, certainly doesn't cause us difficulties in feeling that we can discharge, and to the best of our ability, our role as far as financial stability oversight is concerned, that part of it which we look after. Golly, well, there are a lot of questions in there.
I don't think those at the back would necessarily have heard them all. So if you could repeat some of the questions.
Well, the first one was, isn't there an overlap between the financial risk outlook that the FSA puts forward and the FSR that comes from the bank? I would say yes, there is a bit of an overlap. I'm not sure that it matters awfully. The thrust differs. The FSA's document, of course, takes particular cognizance of investor and consumer factors, whereas our thinking, of course, tries to take into account the overall sort of behavioural aspects of groups of such, whether it's consumers or investors or whatever, but is rather more looking at the sort of macro side of it. And I think that the fact that there's an element of overlap in that inevitably similar subjects may be considered in each, I don't regard that as a matter of concern. The Financial Stability Review is designed to try to enhance better a number of things. First of all, try and enhance better understanding of some of the issues, sometimes to try and see what people actually think about different issues, and we love getting feedback on a number of the matters that we put out, sometimes at an early stage of research, sometimes when a lot more research has been done. Secondly, you asked about the distinction in the responsibilities between the FSA and the bank. All I can say is that I've worked in various of these activities over the last 10 or 15 years, and it doesn't feel at all confusing to us, though I do acknowledge that for those who were familiar with an earlier situation where everything was done in one way, won't necessarily immediately figure out just where dividing lines do exist. To some extent, of course, dividing lines are matters of the legislation, but to some extent I think it's the way that it probably would help you is if you do ask yourself the question, well, what is the sort of key remit of each of the institutions, and FSAs being to a significant extent looking at investor and consumer protection, inevitably that's where focus of activity would be that we don't have. Whereas in our case, looking at the fact that we do have operational capability in providing liquidity both on a day-to-day market, daily basis in enforcing interest rate decisions, which is a more the monetary policy side, but also in the oversight dimension in the areas I talked about, well, you can sort of build back from there the areas where we focus. And of course, we think a lot and we spend a fair amount of time, and also with our colleagues at the Treasury in working out who is doing what in different areas. I do remember a time, and I know certainly one person in this audience is very familiar with it because we were colleagues, when all that seemed to happen was that there was competition between all kinds of bodies involved in the regulatory field. It comes as a surprise to people, but it isn't the way it feels to those of us who work in it. I think we're pretty clear on where the responsibilities lie. The third thing you asked was whether there was a blurring as between banks and non-banks. And as I tried to say in my talk, yes, I think there's a huge blurring that's taken place. That's what gives rise to some of the challenges that we face in financial stability oversight today. Are banks still special? Well, we could spend hours debating what that means. What is clear is that banks obviously do play a very important role in the overall provision of capital, liquidity, and in an intermediated sense within society. But I think that the question of how they differ from different forms of other forms of financial intermediary, there has been a change over time. And as I mentioned, the fact that banks now look at their assets and liabilities in real time and decide, what proprietary positions they want to have is a hugely different situation from that which... Now, when I say that, I don't want to leave everybody with the impression that that's what all bankers are doing all the time. Of course not. What I'm just saying is that as a matter of change and emphasis, that's the direction that banks are moving in, just as securities companies and insurance companies have changed as well.
I think I really ought to bring it to an end here, but we must thank Sir Andrew so much for the very full and frank replies that he's given to all your questions. So thank you very, very much again for being here tonight.